F-16 jets is underway.
Environmental destruction.
Earth has just experienced its warmest day on record, according to Copernicus, Europe's climate agency.
Police murder and mass incarceration. Dehumanization and degradation of women and gender oppression.
Well, a strict new abortion ban goes into effect in Iowa this morning. It prohibits most abortions after about 6 weeks.
Hunting and hounding of migrants who are forced here from all over the world.
Sometimes they fall in, and it's been difficult really to watch when they have to handle children, babies, and try to keep them safe, literally handing them over to somebody who plucks them over to the other side.
All of this has to be swept off the face of the earth through an actual revolution, nothing less. And the revolution we're talking about is something that we are working for in the time we live in now. And that's what we bring to you every week on the Revolution Nothing Less show.
Yeah, and on this show, we bring you the work and leadership of Bob Avakian, who's developed a whole new framework for human emancipation, the new communism, and a strategy for how we can make an actual revolution in this country. And if you want to understand why this revolution is absolutely necessary, why no basic change for the better could come about without overthrowing this system, and you want to understand how this revolution could actually be made in these crazy, intense times we're living in now, you have to follow at Bob Avakian Official on social media. He's on all platforms breaking it down and providing ongoing leadership. Almost twice a week, there's new dispatches coming out. Follow Bob Avakian on social media. Get into it. Spread it to others. And be part of this revolution. Be part of the RevCom Corps for the Emancipation of Humanity.
On today's episode, we want to feature two things. The heart of it is going to be speaking to the situation we're in now, where there is a tremendous amount of anti-immigrant hysteria being whipped up on the one side by the fascist Trump MAGA Republicans who are blaming immigrants for every problem under the sun, the moon, and the stars.
Today, our cities are flooded with illegal aliens. Americans are being squeezed out of the labor force and their jobs are taken. By the way, you know who's taking the jobs? 107% of those jobs are taken by illegal aliens.
And the Democratic Party, including Kamala Harris, have no answer to this.
Do not come. Do not come.
We're going to speak to this by playing a clip from Bob Avakian speaking to the big question that no one talks about, which is, why do people even come here from all over the world? This is taken from a 2003 speech given by Bob Avakian titled Revolution: Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. The other thing we want to feature on today's episode is an interview that was conducted by Sansara Taylor with the writer Alan Goodman, contributor to RevCom.us, who has had ongoing coverage of the genocidal slaughter in Gaza carried out by Israel with full backing, arms, and support by the U.S. This genocide has been taken to extremes even in the last few weeks, and the situation now could boil over to larger regional conflicts.
What's the fallout from the killing of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran? Hamas's political leader was assassinated as tension in the Middle East is running high.
I encourage you to go to RevCom.us, stay tuned, and stay updated. But now, let's go to this interview with Alan Goodman.
Alan Goodman, we have not had you on the RNL show for quite some time, but you've been doing very hard-hitting, very important coverage of the ongoing genocide in Gaza at RevCom.us. I hope all our viewers have been reading and following that, but I'm very, very happy to welcome you back. Glad to be to have you here.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thanks.
All right. So I want to get a picture from you of the situation on the ground in Gaza. Last week, the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, came and addressed a joint session of Congress and got repeated, thunderous, enthusiastic standing ovations, bipartisan from Democrats and Republicans, as he proclaimed that, no, there's no genocide going on. Israel is deploying the most moral army in the history of humanity. They always warn civilians before they bomb. There's virtually no civilian deaths. They've let in so much aid. People should be doing just fine. And this boatload of lies on top of lies was just enthusiastically, rapturously applauded and celebrated, again, both by Democrats and Republicans. it's so important to get an honest picture of what is really going on the ground in Gaza. So why don't you give us a sense of that?
Yeah, well, that was really an obscene, sickening neo-Nazi rally. And yeah, I mean, we could spend, you know, days going through all the lies he told. But I think one of his lies gives, if we deconstruct one of his lies, I think it gives us a picture of what's really going on. So let's start with July 12th. Israel bombed the safe zone that it has declared in the Al-Mawasi area, which is along the Mediterranean coast of Gaza. Gaza's very narrow at the south. It's 7 miles wide. Over here is Israel. Over here is the Mediterranean Sea. So Israel ordered the evacuation of Rafah. We'll come back to this. And essentially have packed nearly a million people into the desert sand on the shores of the Mediterranean and told people this was a safe zone. On July 12th, Israel bombed that safe zone, slaughtering 90 people who were living in tents packed next to each other. A few days later, Israel struck Al-Mawasi again, slaughtering 17 people. Israel claimed that in each instance, they were going after one Hamas operative. So by their count, if their account of what they were trying to do is true, they slaughtered 107 people in an attempt to kill two Hamas operatives. So now let's step back from that incident and go back to the speech that you're talking about. One of the lies Netanyahu told, he set things up with a whole thing about how, oh, the world community was saying, you know, if we invaded Rafah, it would be a catastrophe. You know, people have been following. And why was the world community, really, anybody following things, all aid agencies saying that invading Rafah would be a catastrophe? Because half the population or more of all of Gaza had already been packed into Rafah. So you're invading a place where desperate people who have been driven from Gaza City to Khan Yunis, then to Rafah. Maybe when they left Gaza City, they had a few things they could pack onto a donkey cart and they could take their life savings and pay someone to take them to Khan Yunis. Then they have to flee Khan Yunis and get to Rafah. Now they're living in a UN tent with nothing. Now they're ordered to flee Rafah and go to Al-Mawasi. So Netanyahu told Congress and the world that he went to Rafah and he asked the commander there, how many people did we kill in the invasion? And in the speech, he says that the commander there said, oh, almost none, just a couple dozen people. Well, here's how, got to look at my notes for this, but here's how NBC News described that attack on Rafah. NBC News, by the way, is not a pro-Palestinian news organization. Generally cover up everything going on in Gaza. Here's their description of that bombing, that Netanyahu was, oh, he killed a couple dozen people over. That bombing, according to the NBC News report, left burned, bloody, and mutilated bodies, twisted sheet metal, and fire-blackened earth in its wake. In one video posted to social media, a man could be seen holding up what appeared to be the headless body of a child. Aid agencies estimated that 45 people were killed. And then what you have to factor in here is the generalized atmosphere of terror, the psychological torture. You know, I wrote in my most recent article at revcom.us, living in Gaza is like living on death row in an American prison. You have a death sentence hanging over your head. At any minute, the warden can say your turn. The difference being on death row in America, you get food, water, and a bed. But the same thing with a death sentence hanging over everyone's head. You don't know when you lay your head down in a tent on sand, surrounded by sewage, surrounded by crying babies. You don't know if you will wake up in the morning alive or your loved ones will be there, or you will be subjected to one of these attacks. So you take there's a perfect example, and there are billions, of how Israel and its defenders and its apologists, like those in Nazi rally people, that's what they're applauding over and over and over again. And that's what has been backed up by Biden, by Harris, and of course the MAGA Republican fascists.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, one of the points that you've made in your articles and in our conversation before this interview is that we have to not only take into account each atrocity, each bombing of a hospital, of a refugee camp, of a school where people are sheltering, each time people are told to evacuate point A to go to point B only to be bombed on their way. Each of these is a crime against humanity in its own right, but you've been describing and writing about the cumulative effect.
Well, one illustration of this is a letter to the medical journal The Lancet, which projected 186,000 deaths in Gaza. We hear numbers like 38,000, 39,000 past that now. We hear estimates of 10,000 people buried in rubble. How does that correlate to 186,000 people? People have injuries that they're going to die from. And I think one thing that we can really focus on, and it's a core element of genocide, is creating conditions of life where childbirth is impossible. Those of you who saw my interview with Dr. Majid Jabbar on earlier episode of Revolution Nothing Less Show, and if you didn't, you can catch it. He was talking about, and it was so painful, people are bringing famished babies in, or were before his hospital was shut down by Israel, but we're bringing famished babies in, too famished to feed. There's a medical problem where if a child is really famished, you have to be very careful in introducing food. And they don't have the special formula, the facilities to do this are not available. So the children die, the babies die. You have a whole generation, in a sense, of babies dying now. You have women who are too weak to survive giving birth to children. You have diseases. You have apparently the emergence of polio, a tremendously debilitating and deadly disease, something that could be prevented if the aid agencies that have the vaccine were allowed by Israel to get into the country, get into Gaza and distribute vaccine, and they are prevented from doing that. So you see how this all, the psychological terror, I call it germ warfare, just the creating the conditions where sewage is, rivers of sewage are running through these packed tent camps. People are so weak that they can't survive mild injuries. And it is cumulative, and it's soul crushing. These are human beings. When you imagine if you had gone through this repeatedly, and this is what those monsters and ghouls in Congress on both sides of the aisle were applauding like it was the greatest thing in the world. There's your America. There's this system.
Well, I think that's powerfully true, Alan. And it's really important that you have been covering this, exposing this. It's really important that people who have stood up and protested and raised their voices, it matters. I want to give special shout out to the RevComs who earned honorable mention by Netanyahu when he gave that Nazi speech to Congress.
So these protesters burn American flags even on the 4th of July.
And he denounced those who burn the American flag even on the 4th of July. And we take a lot of pride in having done that. So we'll show some footage of that as well. And just as you said in your closing there, this is America. And it is precisely why that flag deserves to be burned and why people need to be getting organized to bring this system down and bring about a whole different way to live. So I want to thank you so much for joining us again here today.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.
Once again, let me remind you that you are listening to The Michael Slate Show.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Every day, Trump and his MAGA fascists are out blaming immigrants for all the problems in this society. Housing prices too high? Blame immigrants. Fentanyl deaths? Blame immigrants. Crime in your neighborhood? Blame immigrants. Blame immigrants. Blame immigrants. This is straight out of Hitler's playbook, and it has a lot to do with what laying the groundwork for the genocide that followed. And what about the Democrats? They don't use the same dehumanizing rhetoric that the Republican fascists use, but Kamala Harris goes straight to Guatemala and tells the people there, do not come, do not come. The Biden administration has deported more people than any other president, while meanwhile he's denying people's fundamental rights to asylum.
All of this would be bad enough coming out of the mouths of the bloodsuckers who run this country. But a big part of the problem is how many oppressed people are getting roped into this nonsense. And Trump is pushing hard on this, telling black people that immigrants are taking black jobs. And Latino immigrants who are here legally are trying to prove that they're one of the good ones who don't deserve to be rounded up. All of this is being done by a system where there is no black jobs, white jobs, Latino jobs, a system which does not create opportunities for people. It's a system that ruthlessly plunders and exploits people and the planet, and it gets people fighting each other. Continuing to get fooled in this way will only contribute to the dangerous direction things are going. So we want to play for you this following clip from Bob Avakian, where he really speaks to why it is that people come here from all over the world. And what does that have to do with the situation facing people who are oppressed here in this country? So let's take you to this speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, What It's All About, from Bob Avakian in 2003, where he addresses this.
Now I can just hear these reactionary fools saying, well, Bob, answer this. If this country is so terrible, why do people come here from all over the world? Why are so many people trying to get in, not to get out? Maybe we can imagine someone like Vice President Dick Cheney, that crooked mouth monster and worldwide mass murderer. Maybe we can imagine him saying something like this. Yes, Bob, why is that? Why? I'll tell you why. Because you have f***ed up the rest of the world even worse than what you have done in this country. You have made it impossible for many people to live in their own countries as part of gaining your riches and power. Besides everything else that I've mentioned, let's look at what they did in the Congo back in the early 60s and the effect this has had right up to today. The Congo used to be a colony of Belgium. It was the most brutal kind of colonization, working the people literally to death in the mines and other places. They worked them so viciously, literally like slaves, and if they didn't work hard enough, the overseers there would cut off the hands of the people. Finally, after World War II, the people of the Congo got rid of the domination and colonization by Belgium. And they set out to try to build a new country for themselves, and a leader emerged, Lumumba, who was a very popular leader among the people in the Congo. An election was held, and Lumumba won very clearly. But because he was setting out to overcome this legacy of colonialism and all domination by imperialism, the U.S. would not allow it. They maneuvered, they trapped him, they got him into a situation where he was taken and assassinated. And what did they do in place of Lumumba? What did they bring to the people of the Congo? Mobutu, a vicious, brutal tyrant backed by the U.S., kept in power for decades, plundering the people of his own country, building up and amassing tremendous wealth while the people were suffering worse and worse. And then they say, well, see, these people aren't ready for independence. They can't handle their own affairs. Look what happens when they get their independence. Yeah, look what happens. And look deeper and see why. To understand how this system works and how it controls and shapes people's lives, let's look at how people from Mexico and black people end up living alongside each other in somewhere like Watts in Los Angeles or New Jersey or New York City today. It's 1780 or 1800, and someone is walking through their home village in Africa. Maybe they're taking care of a few cattle. Maybe they're tending a few crops. Maybe they're just out for a walk and enjoying the sunny day in the summer. Whatever, all of a sudden they're grabbed and a rope is thrown around them. They're dragged away, never again to see their village or their loved ones. They're transported to a seacoast, where they're sold to slave traders, thrown in the hold of a ship under the most horrific and unimaginable conditions, piled together. If you've ever seen drawings, diagrams of slave ships, people packed together, cargo, as they were called, rats crawling over you day and night, slop at most to eat, never even allowed up on deck to even get any fresh air. If bad conditions arose on the seas, storms developed, the slave ship owners would go among the cargo, the human beings, and decide which one should be thrown overboard so they could save the rest of the cargo so they could make a profit. And through all that horror, you're finally brought to the Americas. Have everything stripped away from you, even your identity. Forced to slave, the people forced to slave away for generations. As the old saying goes, from can't see in the morning till can't see at night. After all the unbelievable horror of what I just described on the slave ship, the Middle Passage, for millions, where millions and perhaps tens of millions died, and those who survived were subjected to these unbelievable conditions of slavery. After generations and centuries of that, finally comes the Civil War. You're promised an end to oppression. You're promised you'll get land and a means for farming the land, 40 acres and a mule. But the promise is broken. After a few years of reconstruction in which a few people got some rights and a little bit of land and property, people were stripped of all that and subjected to all the kind of terror and lynching that I've talked about here. This goes on also for generations. The KKK and the rest of it, forcing you to remain on the plantations, terrorizing you into working for the man, being cheated even when you do work. Finally, after World War II, you're driven off the land. You seek a better life. You go to the city or you go to the north. And what do you face? Once again, betrayal. You are segregated once again, terrorized now by the police. You end up in a housing project that's being allowed and deliberately constructed to rot away. In ancient Mexico, in the beginning of the 1500s, the Spanish conquistadores arrive in what they call the New World. The Spanish conquerors destroy the old ways of life and work people to death in the mines and on plantations called haciendas. This old way of life was not free of exploitation and oppression and plunder, but the Spanish did not come to liberate the people or to do away with exploitation, oppression, and plunder. They came to institute their own, an even worse and far more vicious form of exploitation and plunder, literally working people to death in the mines and on the haciendas, destroying their culture, taking away everything from them. About 150 years ago, after Mexico became independent from Spain, the U.S. waged war on Mexico and stole a large part of its territory. One of the main reasons for this is that the slave owners in the southern U.S. needed more land. The U.S. replaced Spain and other European colonial powers as the force dominating and plundering Mexico. The Mexican Revolution in the early part of the 1900s promised land to the peasants, but there was never a fundamental change, and the masses of people were still trapped in a situation of being exploited as poor peasant farmers while their country is plundered by the U.S. Throughout the 20th century, and even more so in recent years, the ever greater domination of farming in Mexico by big American agricultural companies has ruined the livelihood of millions of more peasant farmers in Mexico who were already living in poor and desperate conditions, but were driven further into such desperate conditions, so much so that they could no longer survive by farming. The Mexican government goes into more and more debt to big banks and financial institutions in the rich countries, especially the U.S. And then, at the insistence of the U.S., it cuts off aid to the peasants who are still trying to survive by farming in Mexico. In effect, the government forces them to grow crops that get sold internationally on what is called the world market, which is controlled by the rich countries and their financial institutions. But the Mexican peasants cannot compete in this world market. They cannot make a living. They can barely survive, if they can survive at all, by farming. Writing in our party's newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, in 1994, shortly after an uprising in Chiapas in the southern part of Mexico, Michael Slate gave a sharp example of this. He wrote about what has happened to Mexican agriculture over the past 30 years. Now, agri means having to do with the land, so agriculture is a way of life based on the land. Slate described how over the last 30 years, Mexican agriculture has been greatly damaged by even more deeply mixed in with and dependent on the world market. Peasant farmers growing things not for their own needs and not necessarily for what is needed in Mexico itself, but what can be sold to big buyers all over the world. Once again, a world market dominated by companies controlling billions of dollars. Deeply in debt and under pressure from the World Bank, which itself is dominated by the U.S., the Mexican government promoted crops that could be sold on the world market in order to try to pay off this debt that it was sinking deeper and deeper into. Land and resources were shifted away from basic food production, and the results have been a disaster for the peasants. In Chiapas, for example, most peasants used to grow corn and beans, but over the years, many switched to growing coffee for export. When the price of coffee fell on the world market in 1990, thousands of Mexican peasants were ruined. And in a recent issue of our newspaper, the RW, there's another article detailing more fully how imperialist domination from the U.S. through things like NAFTA and other ways have further ruined the peasants in Mexico. Another thing mentioned in that article is the maquiladoras in Mexico, just inside the border with the U.S. These are factories that are set up by U.S. companies. They move away from the U.S. and put them just over the border in Mexico. And that line there, that border, is the difference between wages that are 10 times higher on the U.S. side and 10 times lower on the Mexico side. And who works in these maquiladoras? People who can no longer live in the interior, in the countryside, on the farmlands of Mexico, and especially many women who are not only brutally exploited, but also sexually harassed on the job, and many have been murdered coming to and from the job in these border areas. But even that's not enough. Now many of the maquiladoras are being closed down on the border, while some new ones are being built further in the interior of Mexico in order to take advantage of people who are impoverished there. And still others are being moved to other places in Asia and elsewhere where people can be worked for even lower wages because they're even more desperate. So through all this, you find yourself having to leave your home and your homeland in Mexico to go to El Norte, the USA, where you face discrimination and exploitation, living in fear every day of the immigration police, La Migra, if you don't have the necessary papers. You too end up in Watts, or in New York City, or New Jersey, or other cities in the US. In the early 80s, there was a movie starring Jack Nicholson and Elpidia Carrillo called The Border, which dramatically showed the kinds of hardships that drive people and the promises and illusions that call them to cross the border from Mexico into the U.S. And it showed the hardships they suffer once they come to the U.S., the ways in which they are treated as aliens and how they are exploited and brutalized in so many ways. The following lines from the theme song of that movie give a powerful sense of what this means. The bitter disappointment that is found in the so-called promised land of the USA, and the many ways in which people are still hemmed in by the visible and invisible borderline. Now, my voice is hoarse, but I'm going to give this a try. There's a land, so I've been told, every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find. And when you reach the broken promised land, every dream slips through your hand, and you'll know it's too late to change your mind. 'Cause you paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline. For oppressed people who have been through all this, what sense does it make to fight over the crumbs the oppressors leave us? Or to fight for control of things we can never really control under this system, including the very neighborhoods we live in, the neighborhoods they have forced us into while they run these neighborhoods down? What sense does it make to fight each other like that, when we are part of the same class of exploited and oppressed people who can rise up together to put an end to all this? There is a whole long and bitter history in this country and all over the world of the oppressors getting one people they are oppressing to fight against another, all for the benefit of the oppressors themselves. Think about the experience of the Buffalo Soldiers. Bob Marley wrote a song about this. Danny Glover made a movie about it. But the reality is that these were soldiers, black soldiers, who after the Civil War wanted to prove that they were loyal Americans, that they would earn their place now that they won their so-called freedom. And what were they put to doing? Slaughtering the native peoples, finishing them off in their own home territories, carrying forward the genocide against the native peoples and the theft of their land and the resources in their land. It's a bitter lesson. On the other side of the picture, you have the experience of the Cherokees in America. Back in the 1800s, Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, with a great example of American democracy in evidence as president of the United States, and by the way, a slave owner, convinced some of the leaders of the Cherokees that they could get in on all the goodness of America, and he allowed them to purchase plantations. And they even went ahead and purchased slaves and ran slave plantations. But then a few years later, Andrew Jackson and those who ruled the U.S. decided the land was too valuable for Cherokees to have it. So they were driven out of there and sent on a horrific march toward Oklahoma, a death march where especially old people and children died by the wayside, what became known as the Trail of Tears. Another bitter lesson. But the greater lesson is this. We have reached the point in human history and the development of human society where we don't have to be trapped in this kind of situation and played like this anymore. We have the basis. We have the basis not only to unite those who are oppressed under this system, but to sweep away all this garbage they want to keep getting us caught up in, to sweep away the source of all this, their system itself. Now, next, I'm going to get into how all these things flow from the very nature of this system and why it cannot be reformed. It must be done in and done away with. We need a revolution, the most radical revolution in the history of humanity. And I'm going to be talking about what this revolution is all about. But first, it's time for a break and intermission.
You are listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a short musical break and be right back.
Mm-hmm.
I love that clip, you know, and it's so important because when we go out to different neighborhoods, you know, people living side by side don't understand each other's history, and they don't understand the system that's at the root cause of why both of them ended up right next to each other, beefing over the little crumbs that the system throws out to them. And I was just thinking, you know, that story he told about Mexico and how Mexicans ended up in this country, you could tell the same kind of story. It wouldn't be identical, but you could tell the same kind of story about the waves of Venezuelans that are coming, the waves of people from Haiti that are coming, from El Salvador, from Guatemala, all countries that have been completely over by the U.S. and its machinery of imperialist exploitation and domination.
That's right. The other thing you get from this clip is, you know, you see Bob Avakian, not only his heart for what people are being put through, but also how much he sees the potential for people to rise above that, you know, in common cause to make a revolution, to put a put an end to the system that does this to people here and all over the world. We encourage people to really use this clip and some of the dispatches that Bob Avakian has been putting out speaking to this, especially dispatch number 14 and 26, to go to work on transforming this and creating a different situation where people are coming together as emancipators of humanity.
So in coming to a conclusion, I just want to urge you to listen to the most recent Bob Avakian dispatches, where he gets into the intensifying situation and the craziness that's going on right now and the real possibility for revolution. I'm sure everyone watching this has noticed over the last month, the debate debacle where the Republican fascists were on the offensive and Biden could barely even finish a sentence. Then there was the assassination attempt on Trump, the fascist show at the Republican National Convention, Biden dropping out of the race and Kamala Harris stepping in, and this delusional euphoria now for Kamala Harris. You know, these are crazy times, and it's not apparent on the surface what's really going on, where the real interests of humanity are. How do we get fundamental change out of these intense times? This is why it's so important to dig into these dispatches from Bob Avakian, where he breaks this down and helps you see the possibility in this moment.
With that, I want to end on the note that Bob Avakian ends on in his dispatch series. We are talking about a real revolution in the time we're living in now. And if that sounds impossible, look around you. These are times when the impossible is happening and happening more frequently.
We've got some time left, so I'd like to play this.
So just to follow up on last point you made, and you know, some of the people who have been active going out to organize people with that understanding have raised to us that, yeah, but the people say to us, they look out there and they say, you people don't have that many people right now. You're kind of small. And not only that, there's not really the kind of mass resistance we need. And so how are you going to do that? Yeah, what you're talking about sounds good, but it ain't going to happen. What do you say to them?
Yeah, well, a lot of times it looks like something's not going to happen until the night before it does happen. You know, that's one thing to understand, and that has meaning. It's not just a clever thing to say. You know, this is a time of, you know, when things are being accelerated at an increasing pace, you know, and changes. I mean, who anticipated a year ago even that they would overturn Roe v. Wade? You know, a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, the Supreme Court's bad, but they'll never do that. You know, I've read many articles where people were writing and saying they'll never do that because most people in the country support the right to, at least the right to choose. Well, guess what? They did it. You know, and that, you know, things of that kind are going to continue to happen at an accelerated pace. And, you know, so yes, it's true. The forces of revolution, in particular the Rebcoms who base themselves on the new communism, are very small at this time. That's a fact, you know, and we're not gonna try to, you know, bull people and pretend something other than what it is, because we base ourselves on a scientific approach to making revolution, which means actually dealing with the actual reality and telling people the truth about the actual reality. I've told this story before. There was a group, you know, I don't know if they're still around or not, but back in the 60s, there was this group called PL, Progressive Labor. I mean, you can imagine, they're supposedly a communist group. Imagine what kind of communism, what kind of group is supposed to be communist, calls itself Progressive Labor. I mean, come on. Anyway.
Wrong on two counts.
Leaving that aside, you know, like in the economism to the nth degree, you know, just like burying yourself in the narrow struggles, you know, of today. But anyway, one of their members got up at a rally, and I think it was actually they were being interviewed too. And I think it actually got into the New York Times where they said, we have 10,000 members in Harlem. And a bunch of us said, man, what the f*** are you talking about? You don't have any f***ing 10,000 members in Harlem? And the guy said, yeah, I know we don't, but if we say it, maybe we'll get them. Well, that's not the way we're going to approach things with that kind of opportunism. You know, you have to deal with the actual reality. So yes, the forces of revolution are small. Right now, the RevCom forces basing themselves on the scientific method and approach of the new communism are small. And, you know, if it were just a matter of, like, gradually accumulating forces, you know, a few today and a few next week and a few next year, and, you know, with the prospect that maybe in some, you know, never-never land of 70 years from now, maybe we'd have enough people to make a revolution. Well, yes, then you could say that would never happen. But look, I made this point in 2020 when there was a massive upsurge around the murder of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. You know, I said, look around you. Nobody expected this kind of massive outpouring. And yet here it came seemingly out of nowhere, but it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of the underlying contradictions, the oppression of black people in particular and others, Latinos, Native Americans, and the brutal way in which this is daily enforced by murdering pigs. This was the underlying accumulation of contradictions and, you know, and suffering and anguish and outrage finally burst forth when this was just one too many. It's similar to what's happening in Iran now. You know, I mean, there have been many women dragged off the street by their morality police for years and decades. But finally, this one, you know, with this particularly brutal murder of this, yes, that's what it was. You know, you know, the idea of this 22-year-old woman who was perfectly healthy had a heart attack is outrageous. You know, and nobody believes it. Not even the people telling them a lie believe it, I would imagine. Okay, but all of a sudden, things have reached another level. Now, I don't know where all this is going to go at this time. The forces of the ruling class there are still very powerful. But this has gone to a level beyond anything previously. And it's, you know, on the one hand, you know, you could say it's just one more thing. Here's one more woman dragged off by the morality police and brutalized, and it results in her death. But it was just one too many in the context of a lot of other things going on. You know, people are suffering economically and so on. It was just one too many. The same thing in 2020. There were millions of people in the street. What was missing then, and we have to fault ourselves in part for this, although we talked about revolution and put out revolution, we didn't really go and struggle with people about, you know, what this really shows is the need to get rid of the whole system. And you are not going to defund the police. You know, look at what's happened. You know, you got, you know, the great Democratic hero, Joe Biden. The answer is not to defund the police, it's to fund them, fund them, fund them. What'd I say? Fund them. You know, so, you know, but that was a prevailing line. And so, you know, this thing got led off into a side, you know, side stream and, you know, a side street and didn't go anywhere ultimately, even though it was, you know, really heroic outpouring of millions of mm-hmm. people, which was supported by millions more around the world. Who predicted that a month before? I mean, yes, we've been talking for decades and mobilizing people in struggle against police murder for decades. You know, there's a whole national day of protest against police brutality and criminalization of a generation and repression. That goes back to the mid-90s. You know, but all of a sudden, a bunch of things came together. All right, you know, if the revolutionaries had been working the way we should have been, bringing revolution to that and struggling with people, not just about we need revolution in the abstract, but why these other avenues and lines and rows and programs were not going to lead things where they need to go. The question is, why should anybody put up with this kind of, you know, brutal murder time after time after time after time? Why do the parents and loved ones of these people have to shed these tears and cry this anguish time after time after time? Isn't it long past time to put an end to this completely?
Yeah.
Okay, so then what is going to be required to put an end to this and all the other outrages, which we also need to be bringing sharply to light? You know, the oppression of women, the the absolute destruction of the environment, the threat of nuclear war going on, the persecution of the immigrants, and on and on and on. You know, the persecution of gay people and, you know, trans people and so on. You know, in the context of all that, we needed to be saying to people, there's only one solution to this. It's not an easy solution, but it's the only real solution. That's what a scientific approach tells us, because this is rooted in the system and we can show it. And the only way to get rid of all this is to overthrow this system. Now, that would not have led to a revolution right then, but it could have led to accumulating many more forces. And then the next time something jumped off, like what happened with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we'd be in a stronger position with more forces and more ability to impact that situation, so long as we were consistently going out there with revolution. And Lenin made the point, leader of the Russian Revolution and an important communist theoretician, made the point that in these kind of circumstances, which we're living in now, and it's important to understand, decades of ordinary times get concentrated in not only in years, but in months and weeks. And that's what you saw in 2020 on a certain level, not yet to revolution, but that's what you saw. And that's what's going to be increasingly happening. The question is, are the revolutionaries small as they are right now? Yes, we're going to be honest about this. We're not going to try to fool people. That's not scientific. That's not principled. But small as they are, can they go out and drive home to people this lesson and show it in a scientifically grounded, understandable way, not talking like, well, you must understand it's the imperialist system that causes all these horrors in the world. And the first thing we need is a proletarian revolution, which first occurred in 1917 after the failure of the Paris Commune in 1871 and was taken to its highest level by the Chinese Cultural Revolution. That's not what I'm talking about, okay? But to go out and in a living way present to people the actual reality of what this is all rooted in, why things are accelerating the way they are, how the ruling class is increasingly an antagonistic, unresolvable conflict within itself, and how this provides opening for us to actually get rid of all this oppression by scientifically understanding that it's rooted in the very workings of this system, the very dynamics and the very relations of this system, and that we can mobilize and win over the forces, most of all people who are catching the worst hell under this system, which are millions and tens of millions, but also people from other parts of society who hate injustice and who want a better future for humanity and don't want to have nuclear weapons raining down on humanity, don't want the environment to be destroyed. We can win increasing numbers of them over, and it's going to all be very accelerated one way or the other. So we've got to go out with that understanding and give that understanding to the masses of people, like I said, in very basic terms and in everyday language, not in a stilted language that I was just, mocking, to be blunt. But, this is where building up the forces for revolution in a growing way. Today there are small numbers. Tomorrow there are, hundreds verging on thousands. Then there are thousands, and when there are thousands, those thousands make millions sit up and take notice. You see thousands of people all together, firmly convinced of the need for revolution, not in some sort of religious sense, but with a scientific foundation in basic terms. You see them on the political stage, influencing the political terrain, the how things are shaping up. Millions of people start taking notice. And millions of people who are telling us today, oh, that'll never happen, start thinking a little differently, or at least questioning, well, maybe it could happen. And then, the question is, do you have a leading force, a core leading this, that has the scientific method approach and has an actual strategy and plan for how to build up the forces for revolution, how to work to create the conditions for revolution, carry out what we call the three prepares, prepare the ground, the political situation, prepare the masses of people, and prepare the vanguard leadership so that you can go all the way with revolution. And people are going to start sitting up and taking notice. Wow, there are people out here, and they're very serious about this, and they have a scientific approach which they can explain to me in terms that I can actually understand, and they've got a strategy and a program for how to go about this and how to win when the time comes. Not that they've given us a guarantee, but they have a strategy for how to go about winning, and they've got a whole vision and concrete blueprint for what to do when we do win, namely the Constitution for the new socialist republic in North America.
And that brings us to the end of another show here at the Michael Slate Show. I'd like to thank Andy Z and everybody at the Revolution Nothing Less Show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And again, check out the RevComs on YouTube at youtube.com/TheRevComs and follow at Bob Avakian Official on all your social media platforms. And remember, the problem is not human nature, it is the nature of the system. Through a real revolution, a better world is possible. My name is Sansara Taylor. I'll talk to you again next week.
Yeah. The people, they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and want a peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh yeah, fuck the police. Actors and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You could pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means, AIPAC, Koofy, and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You could ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late. We've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children, and all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the color of your pigment. But white supremacy is finally on blast, screaming free Palestine to their home at last. We see the lies and claiming it's anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist. I've seen Jewish brothers and sisters out there and writhing in solidarity and screaming free Palestine with them organizing and learning and finally cutting ties with a state that's gotta rely on apartheid system to uphold and occupy and violent history been repeating for the last 75.